Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the 2005 annual public lecture of London School of Economics' Centre for Philosophy of Natural and Social Sciences. As you can tell from the visual aids already in process, it is my great pleasure to introduce Simon Singh, who will give us a talk on the topic of his book, 2004, The Big Bang. As you will know, many of you, as your numbers here attest, Simon is renowned as one of Britain's most foremost science writers, with his 1997 book, Fermat's Last Theorem, being a number one bestseller, followed by The Code Book, and now last year, Big Bang. So, Simon, thank you very much for coming, and we will have, of course, the discussion period afterwards, and indeed a chance to buy a book with more details later. But, Simon, thank you for coming, and over to you.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me here this afternoon. I've been to a couple of other lectures in this series in the past, so it's actually nice to be up here talking about my own favourite subject, which is the Big Bang. As Jeremy was saying, this is a book that I wrote last year. I came up with a title about 3 years ago, Big Bang. That's when I started writing it. It just seemed like a short, punchy, snappy title. It was to the point. The only problem was that last year another book was published at exactly the same time with exactly the same title. So that's my Big Bang. The other version is Big Bang, the only sex manual you'll ever need. And I only mention this in case there are people here under a misapprehension, because by the end of the talk you're going to be really, really disappointed. The point of writing this book was that it just suddenly struck me that for thousands of years we've wondered where the universe came from. We've wondered, where did everything come from? And we've come up with myths and theories and so on. But now, for the first time ever, we've got a coherent theory. It's compelling, it's consistent, it's verifiable. And it's not perfect, but it's incredibly impressive. And I wanted to celebrate that fact and tell people what the Big Bang Theory is, who came up with it, and why we believe in it. So that's what I'm going to try and do this evening, is to talk about what the Big Bang Theory is, who came up with it, and why we actually believe in it. And I'm going to skip over various things and gloss over things, and I'm not going to get to the whole... I hope to get to the point in the story where the name Big Bang was invented. But whatever I gloss over or whatever I don't get to, hopefully we can cover in the questions and answer session at the end. I'm going to start the story in 1930. In 1930, this chap, Sir James Jeans, wrote a book, very eminent British astrophysicist. His book was called The Mysterious Universe. And it was his attempt 75 years ago to explain to the public what cosmologists in 1930 understood about the universe and its history and its origins. It was a big hit, not just here in Britain, but also in America. The Hollywood screen actress, Tallulah Bankhead, she read it. She liked it so much, she said it contained what every girl should know. So clearly a popular work. But he didn't mention anything about the Big Bang Theory. Sir James Jeans wrote about a completely different type of universe. His universe was eternal and static. It had been here forever. It was going to stay here forever. You know, the odd star might be born and the odd star might die, but essentially the universe stayed the same forever and ever and ever. Now, the Big Bang Theory, on the other hand, says that the universe hasn't been here forever. It was created a finite time ago in a hot, dense state, and it's evolved radically into the universe we see today, and it continues to evolve into the future. So the two theories are diametrically opposed. One says the universe has been here forever, it doesn't change. The other one says, no, it hasn't been here forever, it was created, and it has changed. So the first thing is, who came up with the Big Bang Theory? Well, one of the pioneers was Georges Lemaître, a Belgian cosmologist. He talked about a primeval atom. He imagined that all the matter in the universe had been compressed into one almighty atom. That atom had ruptured and thrown its debris outwards. The debris had coalesced into the stars and galaxies. And if his theory was right, the stars and galaxies today should still be flying apart as a result of this kind of cosmic explosion. He didn't talk about the Big Bang. He spoke of a day without a yesterday. But essentially, this is the Big Bang theory. And we don't talk about a primeval atom anymore. But more or less, this is the Big Bang theory that we know today. The establishment rejected it immediately. The establishment said, no, we like the eternal universe. If the universe has been here forever, we don't need to worry about when it was created, how it was created, or who created it. And who created it is important because, as you can see, Lemaître was a priest. And people said, look, the reason you want creation is because creation implies a creator. And you're just trying to smuggle God into physics when no one's looking. He said, no, I like this theory because it's good physics. He acknowledged that he was religious, and he once said, there are two ways of arriving at the truth, and I decided to follow them both. And by that he meant religion told him about the spiritual world, science told him about the material world. And he didn't use his science to back up his faith, and he didn't use the Bible to back up his theories. But still people didn't believe him. Even Einstein met him at a Solvay conference, and Lemaître told him about the Big Bang theory. Einstein said, your calculations are correct, but your physics is abominable. Which is a fair point. What Einstein was saying is theoretically what you're saying makes sense, but science is more than just about theory. It's about reality. So does your theory tally with reality? You have to check your theory against reality. If you don't check your theory against reality, you can be completely wrong. And this is what Einstein was speculating. He was saying theoretically it's okay, but in terms of reality, it doesn't make sense. Just to show you how important it is to check your theories against reality, I'm going to show you a theory here which seems to suggest that the Teletubbies are evil. We know that the BBC put a lot of time and money into the Teletubbies, so the Teletubbies are a product of time and money. We also know that time is money. So we can substitute back into the first equation, and we all know that that's money squared. We also know that money is the root of all evil. So money squared is evil, and therefore the Teletubbies are evil, okay? But I should stress this is only a theory. It's only a theory. If you wanted to prove it, you'd have to do an experiment. And here's a scientist doing an experiment on a Teletubby. So if Lemaître wanted to prove his theory, he had to do an experiment. Or in astronomy, you tend to make observations. Or someone would have to make an observation for him. And the observations for the Big Bang were first made at Mount Wilson Observatory in Southern California, home of the biggest and best telescopes in the world. This is the giant 100-inch telescope. And as well as having the best telescopes, they had the best astronomers. This is a chap called, this is Edwin Hubble, after whom the Hubble Space Telescope is named. He was a brilliant astronomer, and not just brilliant, not just intellectually gifted, but also very charismatic. So people would travel all the way from Los Angeles, from Hollywood. Great film stars would travel all the way to Mount Wilson to meet the great Hubble, who really became a celebrity in his lifetime. And in fact, his future wife went on one of these tourist trips to Mount Wilson. And when she went on this trip to Mount Wilson, she saw Hubble standing in the distance. And the moment she saw him, she never forgot that moment. She was captivated. She went on later to describe him. She remembered that moment. He was standing there in the distance looking at a photograph of a galaxy that he'd taken the previous night. And when she saw him, she described him as an Olympian, tall, strong, and beautiful, with the shoulders of the Hermes of Praxiteles. There was a sense of power channeled and directed in an adventure that had nothing to do with personal ambition. So clearly love at first sight. Unfortunately, she was already married at the time, and she was married to a geologist, which is never a very nice thing. But 3 weeks later, her husband fell down a mine shaft and was killed, so it's kind of a happy ending there. So what did Hubble do in terms of proving the Big Bang? Well, Hubble was interested in galaxies, so the galaxies are these collections of stars. Each galaxy maybe contains 100 billion stars, and the universe is full of billions of galaxies. What Hubble wanted to know is, what do these galaxies do? You know, we know they rotate within themselves, but what do they do relative to each other? Do they move relative to each other? Do they move randomly? Do they move systematically? Maybe they don't move at all. Maybe they just float in space doing nothing. That's what Hubble wanted to find out, the dynamics of the cosmos. So how would you ever find out the motion of the galaxies? Well, all you'll ever get from a galaxy is light. So you have to pick up some clues from that light. And so light is a wave, and the wavelength is critical. If it's a long wavelength, that's red. If it's a short wavelength, that's blue or violet. That's all you really need to know about light in this context. Long wavelength, red, short wavelength, blue, violet, intermediate wavelengths, intermediate colors like orange and yellow and green. Now, Hubble knew that the galaxies should emit and absorb all the same colors. The galaxies are made of the same stuff we're made of. They're made of nitrogen and carbon and hydrogen and helium. We know what colors those atoms should emit and absorb. For example, sodium always emits orange. On this scale, it emits 589 nanometers, 589 billionths of a meter. Any sodium atom, if you excite it, will always emit that very specific wavelength. That's why sodium lamps are orange, because sodium lamps are stimulated atoms of sodium. They emit orange. Just to prove to you the universal nature of this law, I'm just going to electrocute a gherkin. So just bear with me a second. So these gherkins are pickled in brine. And because they're pickled in brine, they're saturated with sodium chloride. If they're saturated with sodium chloride, they've got lots of sodium atoms in them. And I should stress, really don't try this at home. This is not, this is not big, but it is rather clever, actually. So if I pass... mains voltage through this, the sodium atom should become excited, and that should give off a classic orange color that you get with sodium lamps, because that's what sodium does. So here we go. Oh, there we go. So it's not going red hot, it's not going white hot, it's jumping straight to orange, because that's associated with the sodium atoms. And really, you really don't want to try that. That's not not very safe. So the galaxy should have emitted very particular colors, and that would have been one of them. But when Hubble looked at the galaxies, they didn't emit those colors that he expected. And that was because of something called the Doppler shift. It is Christian Doppler. He was interested in waves, not just light waves, but also sound waves. So here's an object emitting sound waves. It's sending out the sound waves symmetrically. So I've got a beeper here. If I switch the beeper on, it sends out the sound waves equally in all directions. It's like you're tapping the surface of a pond and you're sending out ripples. Wherever you are, you hear the same wavelength, so you hear the same pitch. But look at what happens if the object starts to move. The object's now moving to the right, so it sends out these waves, and as it moves to the right, the waves on that side get cramped. The waves behind it get drawn apart. So now the two microphones hear different pitches, because the microphone on the right encounters a short wavelength or a high pitch. The microphone on the left encounters a long wavelength or a low pitch. So now, even if you can't see the object, you know its direction of motion just by listening to it. If the pitch is higher than it should be, you know it's coming towards you. If the pitch is lower than it should be, you know it's moving away. And that's called the Doppler shift. And if I spin this around my head, as it comes towards you, you should hear a higher pitch. And as it moves away from you, you should hear a lower pitch. Let's see if that's... Can people hear that effect? If you're in the front, you may not hear it very well at the front because you're at a shallow angle. I can't hear it myself because it's going around me and not towards or away from me. But if you're fairly square on, you should have heard a variation in pitch. So that's the Doppler effect. And it happens not just for sound, but it also happens for light. So here's a galaxy. The galaxy's heading to the right. It's moving away from me. So now all the light waves are being stretched if I'm on this side. So all the light waves will look redder than they ought to, because long wavelength, well, that's red. If the galaxy is moving towards you, then the light waves get squashed. Short wavelength is blue or violet. So all the colors will look slightly bluer than they should. Okay? So instead of giving off that perfect orange, if the galaxy is moving away from me, it'll give off a slightly reddy orange. If it's moving towards me, it'll give off a slightly bluey orange. And all the colors will either be blue shifted or they'll either all be red shifted, depending on whether the galaxy is moving away from me or towards me. Just to reiterate this point, I'm just going to play you a song. This is the Cosmic Doppler song. It's an a cappella song about astrophysics. And they're going to summarize in about 15 seconds everything I've just said. It's crucial for what comes next. Red shift moving away from me, blue shift coming towards me. They're going to talk about frequencies rather than wavelengths, but it's all essentially the same. The Cosmic Doppler song by the Chromatics. Here we go.
Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum,
ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum, ba-dum.
You see it, it's true.
Doppler shift
to the red or the blue. When a star is approaching and it's coming our way, its spectrum seems bluer, won't you hear what I say? And when a star's retreating way out of range, and the scientist measures its frequency change, well, that's a red shift if the star is moving away.
So what happened when Hubble looked at these colors? What did he see? Well, here are some measurements he took. These are three galaxies he looked at. He looked at the first galaxy, and it was slightly redder than it should have been. Slightly redder means it's moving away. The amount of redness told him it was moving away at 6 billion kilometers a year. The second one was even redder. So it was also moving away even faster. Third one, even redder still. Moving away at 730 billion kilometers a year. If a plane could travel that fast, it would go around the world in about 10 seconds. So these are all quite phenomenal speeds. But it's not the speed that's important. What's important is the direction of motion. Every time that Hubble looked at a distant galaxy, it was moving away. And that's exactly what you would expect if the universe started with a big bang. Big bang, big explosion, debris moves apart, debris forms galaxies, galaxies still moving apart. And that's what we're seeing here. This is the very first evidence to back up Lemaître's idea of a big bang theory. You can even work out when the big bang happened. Presumably when the big bang happened, all the matter was back in one place. So we can ask the question, how long would it take a galaxy moving at 6 billion kilometers a year? How long would it take to get 9 billion billion kilometers away? We can just divide the distance by the speed. And if we do that, we get 1.5 billion years. Crudely, that's how long that galaxy would have taken to get that far away, moving at that speed. Second one, it's further away, but it's moving faster. So if we divide 220 by 170, we get 1.3 billion years ago. Third one, further away, faster still, we get a very similar number. These measurements are incredibly difficult. So when you get this kind of consistency, what that's telling you is that roughly 1.5 billion years ago, all the matter was back in one place, compact. So presumably that's when the Big Bang happened, according to Hubble's data. So let's just summarize where we are. 1927, that's when Lemaître came up with his Big Bang theory. 1929, that's when Hubble came up with these measurements, this bit of evidence. And yet, in 1930, we started talking about Sir James Jeans in his book, The Mysterious Universe. And in 1930, he didn't mention the Big Bang in his book. So how can that be the case, that we've got a good theory up here, we've got some proof here, and yet this chap and the whole scientific establishment continue to ignore the Big Bang. Why is the Big Bang theory being ignored despite good theory, despite good evidence? Well, there are two reasons, several reasons. I'm just going to touch on two of them. One is that the data I've just shown you implies that the Big Bang happened 1 or 2 billion years ago. We got dates like 1.3, 1.6, 1.5. So Hubble's data implies that the universe is just 1 or 2 billion years old. Well, people already knew that the Earth was at least 3.5 billion years old. So this is clearly absurd. According to the Big Bang, the universe is younger than the Earth. So if you didn't like the Big Bang theory, immediately you could reject it on these numbers alone. Now, later on, people spotted errors in Hubble's measurements, and it turned out that the universe is much older. We now know that the universe is about 14 billion years old. So the age discrepancy went away. But even though the age discrepancy went away, still people didn't believe in the Big Bang. So the second reason why people didn't believe in the Big Bang is rather hard to explain. But I'm going to try and explain it using the music of Led Zeppelin. That even threw me for a second. I'm just going to play you a few seconds of Stairway to Heaven. And just bear with me on this, and all will become clear in a little bit.
If there's a bustle in your hedgerow, don't be alone there. It's just a sprinkling for the May Queen.
So the question is, just to remind you, the question is, why don't people believe in the Big Bang? We've got evidence, we've got theory, the age discrepancy is going away. Why are people still rejecting the Big Bang theory? I'll come back to that question in a second. But what I'm going to do first, I'm going to play you that same song, Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven. But this time I'm going to play it to you backwards, okay? So again, about 15 seconds worth, Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven. Just have a listen to this and see what you make.
It's my sleeping. The world will meet up at 48. It's a first hour at 8. You can't throw me in your tits at 6. I'm all in with the war shade. I need a summer at 6.
Okay, so just out of interest, hands up if you heard the word Satan. Hands up. So I reckon that's about 20 or 25 people heard the word Satan. Okay, hands up if you heard the word, here's to my sweet Satan. The one whose little path would make me sad, whose power is Satan. Oh, he'll give you 666. There was a little tool shed where he made us suffer, sad Satan. Hands up if you heard that. Hands up if you heard... Just me, right. right. The extraordinary thing is, and this, I promise you, this will change your life. I'm going to play this to you again, and this time you will hear these words, okay? I promise you two things. One, I'm not cheating. This is going to be so shocking, you'll think I'm cheating, but I'm not cheating. What I'm going to play you is exactly what you've just heard. Just Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, just play backwards the way you've just heard it. I'm not going to manipulate it or treat it in any way. And the second thing I promise you is you will hear all of these words, okay? So here we go, Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, the way you've just heard it, but this time you too are going to hear all of these words. Here we go. Now, I find that truly shocking. I mean, I've done this a few times, and each time this happens. You know, the first time you play it, nobody hears anything, or maybe the odd word. The second time you play it, you get a whole entire coherent paragraph about Satan and his tool shed. So what's going on? Well, the truth is there's nothing there, okay? It's a song played backwards. When you play a song backwards, you get gibberish. That's all there is to it. There is nothing there. But before I played it to you again, I showed you some words. I showed you a pattern of words, and I implanted them in the back of your head. More than that, I compelled you to hear them. I said, I promise you, you'll hear these words. And you probably wanted to hear them. You wanted to play along. You didn't want to miss out. And your brain is this wonderful computer that loves to find meaning. It loves to find patterns. So, you know, you've had so many conversations in noisy corridors or down bad telephone lines that your brain often has to piece together meaning from very poor data. And 99% of the time, your brain gets it spot on. But every so often, it gets it badly wrong, especially if it's been given a big bias or an expectation or a prejudice. Your brain ends up hearing something that really is not there. And that's what's happened here. So what's this got to do with the Big Bang? Well, scientists are only human too. So scientists presented with bad data can also see things that aren't there. Because of their bias and their expectation and prejudice, they interpret the data, especially if the data is very bad. So for example, at the time, the bias and prejudice was for an eternal universe. All the professors said that the universe was eternal. All the textbooks said that the universe was eternal. So when scientists looked at the data that Hubble gave them, and Hubble's first set of data was very poor, very open to interpretation, scientists interpreted it with that bias and viewed it as though the universe was still eternal. So, for example, here's a chap who did just that. This is a chap called Fritz Vicky, a very grumpy astrophysicist. I'll just tell you one thing about him, was if he didn't like you, he had a very good insult. His favorite insult was to call people a spherical bastard. And by that, he meant that a sphere is a geometrical object which looks the same whichever way you look at it. And a spherical bastard is someone who's a bastard whichever way you look at them. So, so he was biased. You know, he believed that the universe had been here forever. And people said, but look, the galaxies are moving away. They look red. That's, you know, they look red because they're moving away. That's the Big Bang theory. He said, no. They do look red. I can't deny that. But the reason they look red is not because they're moving. The reason they look red is that the galaxies emit light. The light gets scattered by dust and gas. When light gets scattered, it loses energy. And when light loses energy, it looks red. Okay? So nothing was moving. Galaxies emit light. Light gets scattered. Light looks red. We call it the tired light hypothesis. And in terms of physics, it's perfectly sensible. There's nothing wrong with his theory. It's slightly biased. It's slightly colored by his expectation. But logically, it's perfectly reasonable. So those people who didn't want to believe in the Big Bang could quite happily reject it because the data could be was open to interpretation. Now, it turns out with more measurements, the tired light theory breaks down. But still people held on to the belief in the eternal universe. This is Fred Hoyle on the right, Herman Bondi in the middle, and Thomas Gold on the left. They believed in the eternal universe. And they still maintained their belief in the eternal universe. They accepted that the galaxies are moving apart. That much they accepted. They didn't believe in the tired light hypothesis. They accepted that the galaxies really are moving apart. So on the one hand, the universe is clearly changing. On the other hand, if you want eternity, you kind of need a universe that's going to stay the same. Okay, so they wanted a universe that stayed the same, but clearly it was changing. So they came up with a theory. Their theory was that the universe changes, but stays the same. Okay, which sounds paradoxical. I'll explain you their theory in a moment. They built an entire cosmological theory based on the principle that the universe changes but stays the same. They got their theory by going to see a film called Dead of Night, which is it's a horror film, and it's the first horror film made after the war. And it's actually an Ealing horror film. People have heard of Ealing comedies. This is actually an Ealing horror. And if I tell you the story of this film, you'll see why it inspired Hoyle to come up and Gold and Bondi to come up with their theory. The film tells the story of a young man who's fast asleep. He's having a dream. And in the middle of this dream, he suddenly wakes up. He realizes he's late. He gets washed. He gets dressed. He jumps into his car. He drives into the countryside. In the middle of the countryside, his car breaks down. He goes looking for help. He knocks on a door. He goes into a house. The house is full of strangers, people he's never met before. But he says, this is really weird, because even though I've never met any of you, I recognize you from a dream that I was just having last night. And the people in the house are a bit bemused and a bit perplexed and suspicious, but they're also intrigued. And one by one, the people in the house tell the visitor about their strange experiences, weird things that have happened to them in the past. And the film is a collection of short stories told by the people in the house. And when they finish telling the visitor their weird stories, the guests in the house stand up and walk towards the visitor, and they grab him by the neck, and they begin to throttle him, and they begin to strangle him. And just as they're about to strangle him to death, he wakes up. He gets washed, he gets dressed, he jumps into his car, he drives into the countryside, his car breaks down, he goes into a house looking for help. House is full of strangers. He says, this is really weird, I've never met any of you before, but I recognize you from a dream I just had last night. And the film could continue. So here's a film that clearly changes. It's got plot development, it's got new characters, and yet it kind of stays the same. And it could go on for eternity. So Hoyle, Gold, and Bondi said, well, can we build a model of the universe? It clearly changes, but stays the same. And first of all, they thought quite small scale. They thought, well, you know, on a human scale, we change every day. Every day, millions of cells die. But every day, those cells get replaced. And after about 6 years, every cell in our body, apart from our brain and our liver, after 6 years, every cell in our body has been replaced. And after 6 years, from head to toe, we are a completely different person. We've changed, but we kind of feel we're the same. I still feel that I'm me, and you still feel that you're you. So things can change and stay the same if there's a kind of replenishment to make up for the destruction. So how do you apply this to the universe? Well, Gold, Bondi, and Hoyle develop what they call the steady-state universe. Now, before I explain the steady-state universe, let's just remind ourselves of the Big Bang universe. Each of these dots is a galaxy. And in the Big Bang universe, the universe expands and moves apart. So each of the galaxies moves further apart, and the universe gets bigger and emptier and more desolate. That's the Big Bang theory. In the steady-state universe, the galaxies move apart, but in between the galaxies, new matter is being created, these tiny dots. So baby galaxies are being born in between the galaxies as they move apart. The baby galaxies grow up to be big galaxies as the bigger galaxies move further apart. Okay? So we have the moving apart compensated for by this replenishment, by the creation of new matter. So what you end up with here is a universe that looks pretty much the same as the universe here. Equal distribution of matter. Okay, this universe is bigger than this one, but if the universe is infinite, then twice infinity is still infinity, so that doesn't make a huge difference. What you have here is a universe that clearly changes dramatically, gets bigger and emptier and more desolate, and you can track this universe back to a beginning. This one doesn't go back to a beginning. It just gets embedded in an even bigger universe. And it doesn't really change very much. It carries on forever, and it could have carried on forever. So what you have in 1950 is you have two theories of the universe. You have Fred Hoyle championing the steady state, which is a universe that's been here forever, and then you have Georges Lemaître championing the Big Bang, which is a universe that's been here for a finite amount of time and was created. And the whole cosmological community is divided in 1950. Some believe in the Big Bang, some believe in the steady-state universe. And I should stress, actually, this is the point in the story where the name Big Bang was invented. And it was actually invented by Fred Hoyle. Fred Hoyle, who hated the Big Bang, was the person who actually coined the name. He was giving a radio broadcast for the BBC, and he was comparing the two theories. And when he compared the two theories, he was quite dismissive about the Big Bang because he didn't like the Big Bang. And he said, you know, how can we believe that the universe started with some kind of explosion, some kind of big bang? And it was kind of a glib, throwaway comment, almost an insulting, derisory comment. But the name stuck, and we've used it ever since. And in fact, I've got the actual recording. I'll play it for you now. This is the BBC radio show in 1950 where Hoyle was lecturing, and it's about 30 seconds long, this clip. And just before the end, you'll hear him use the phrase Big Bang. And it's the very, very first time anybody ever used the expression Big Bang. Here we go.
The BBC presents the seventh talk in the series, The Nature of the Universe. The speaker is Fred Hoyle, a Cambridge mathematician and fellow of St. John's College. Mr. Hoyle.
The mysterious feature of the universe is that the background material and the galaxies are inferred from observation to be in a state of expansion. What explanations have been offered to account for all this? First, I'll consider the older ideas. Broadly speaking, the older ideas fall into two groups. One of them is distinguished by the assumption that the universe started its life a finite time ago in a single huge explosion. On this supposition, the present expansion is a relic of the violence of this explosion. Now, this Big Bang idea seemed to me to be unsatisfactory, even before detailed examination showed that it leads to serious difficulties.
So this Big Bang theory sounds to me unsatisfactory. So he was using the phrase in a very sort of derisory way, but the name stuck. The critics carried on using it, and the fans kept on using it, and we've used the phrase Big Bang ever since. There was an alternative name suggested by a couple of experts in the field in 1992. Calvin and Hobbes were discussing the Big Bang theory, and Calvin said, like, I like the Big Bang theory, I just don't like the name. I think it's a silly name. And Hobbes says, well, can you come up with a better name? And Calvin says, yes, I think we should call it the Horrendous Space Kablooey. And for a little while, scientists actually wrote papers about the HSK theory of creation. But the Big Bang is a name we've come to kind of know and love. And I sort of just want to finish with a couple of things before we come to sort of the Q&A. The two things I want to stress to you before I finish are I've given you the impression that scientists make up their minds based on bias and prejudice and expectation. Lemaître liked the Big Bang theory maybe because it was his idea. Hoyle liked the steady state theory maybe because he found some appeal in the idea of eternity. Some people liked the Big Bang theory because it had a resonance with Genesis. Some people didn't like the Big Bang theory because it had a resonance with Genesis. But cosmologists were clearly making up their minds on sort of all sorts of philosophical and aesthetic reasons. And that's how science works. Scientists have biases and prejudices, and that's how they make up their minds. But only when they don't have enough data. When you don't have data, that's all you can do is speculate on bias and prejudice. And scientists hate that. Scientists hate it when they don't have the data. And what good science is all about is getting good data. When you get the good data, then that gets rid of the bias and the prejudice. It gets rid of any room for interpretation. And that's what the battle has been for the last 50 years, has been to get the good data, which means that unequivocally you can tell which of these theories is right and which one's wrong. And over again, as the data's come in, it's the Big Bang theory that's been vindicated, and it's a steady state theory that's been proved wrong. And that's the great thing about science, is that if you get the data, if you can do the experiments, you can get the right answer. You can get some handle on the objective truth. Now, I should stress that, I mean, Hoyle was an incredibly smart guy, a brilliant cosmologist. His idea is very beautiful. He clearly wanted his idea to be true, and he was highly respected. He was Sir Fred Hoyle. But at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how respected you are, it doesn't matter how clever you are, it doesn't matter how much you want your theory to be true, it doesn't matter how beautiful your theory is. If it doesn't match the data, you have to get rid of it. My favorite quotation in sort of science is by Huxley, Thomas Huxley, and he said, there's nothing more tragic in science than the slaying of a beautiful hypothesis by an ugly fact. And that's all that science is. That's all that science is. So I just want to finish with one example of one of those measurements one of those ugly facts that in the end killed off the steady state theory. This is a rather unusual photo. I won't bother explaining it, how it came about, but this is George Gamow, a Ralph Alpha, and Robert Herman. And in 1948, they said, if there was a Big Bang, then the Big Bang should have been followed by a blast of radiation. And if there was a Big Bang, that radiation should still be here today. It should be here in the form of microwaves. The whole of space should be full of microwaves. So go out, look for the microwaves. If you see the microwaves, you know there was a Big Bang. If you don't find them, then you know there wasn't a Big Bang. So this is a really nice prediction because it's a make or break test. There's no wriggle room. You can't really wheedle your way out of this. Except for the fact people didn't have the detectors. They couldn't pick up the microwaves because they didn't have the technology. So this prediction made in 1948 was pretty much forgotten and neglected. And then in 1965, though, these two guys came along. This is Robert Wilson on the left and Arno Penzias on the right. They were radio astronomers. And in radio astronomy, you use these big radio telescopes to pick up the radio waves coming from galaxies. And you can study what's going on inside a galaxy by looking at the radio waves. And before they pointed it at a galaxy, they wanted to calibrate the detector. So they pointed their telescope away from a galaxy. Pointed at nothing, you should get nothing, that way you can calibrate the detector. But when they pointed it at nothing, they picked up microwaves. Microwaves being a type of radio wave. So they pointed it somewhere else. They still got microwaves. They waited 24 hours. They still got microwaves. They wondered if the microwaves might be coming from inside the detector. Maybe there was something to do with the wiring or something. They checked the wiring. The wiring was all fine. They then realized that deep inside the telescope, there were two pigeons that had nested. And the pigeons had deposited what they diplomatically called a white dielectric material. So they got a big pigeon trap. They caught the pigeons. They took the pigeons back to their offices 10 miles away. They released the pigeons. Pigeons being pigeons just flew straight back. They got their trap. They caught the pigeons again. They shot them. They cleaned up the white dielectric material, but still the microwaves kept on coming. They couldn't figure out where these microwaves were coming. And eventually somebody tapped them on the shoulder and they said, look, what you've discovered is the microwave from the Big Bang. What you've discovered is the afterblast of creation. And sure enough, the wavelength of these microwaves were exactly as you'd expect if they came from the Big Bang. The only way to explain these microwaves is in the context of the Big Bang. This microwave radiation, which is bombarding us all the time, is the most compelling evidence that the Big Bang really happened. We know the dinosaurs existed because we see the dinosaur fossils. We know that the Big Bang happened because of this kind of fossil radiation. If you ever tune a radio in between stations and you get a hissing sound, 1 or 2% of the energy that your aerial is picking up is due to these microwaves from the Big Bang. This is real compelling evidence to back up the Big Bang theory. And that's the pigeon trap they used. If you're ever in Washington, you can go to the Smithsonian Museum and actually visit it. So I'm going to stop there. I started in 1930. With Sir James Jeans. He wrote a book called The Mysterious Universe. That was his attempt to explain to the public what we know about the universe. Very popular. Tallulah Bankhead enjoyed it very much. I've tried to update the story. What do we believe today? I'm nowhere near as eminent or as smart as Sir James Jeans. But I do share one goal in common with him, and that's that maybe one day Cameron Diaz will say that my book contains what every girl should know. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Simon. Well, as the applause attests, it's what every girl and boy should know, and we all do now, or will once we've bought a copy shortly. Would you like to take a seat, sure. Then? And make sure that these work.
Yes, these work.
So if you make yourself comfortable, defies summary, but you've had gherkins, Tallulah Bankhead, white dielectric material, these things all prompt questions. and it's my pleasure to invite somebody to start, if they'd like to. Good, sir.
Are okay until they fail. But we had a professor here who claimed that all scientific theories fail all the time. And it seemed to me you gave a wonderful example of that with the Big Bang. At the beginnings, it was the universe was thought to be about 1.5 billion years old. But the prevailing theory was it was 4 billion years old. So in the first instance, it seems to me you have confirmed an LSE fallibilist theory of science that all theories are born refuted. And I would like you to comment on that.
Okay. So
I have another question, if that's okay.
Well, maybe I'll just try that one.
Okay, sure.
Just so we get right to maybe more people as well. So I think maybe you're suggesting the Big Bang Theory, again, one day will get overturned. And I think what happens in science is that some theories are fundamentally wrong. And if we look at the eternal universe model, it turned out to be fundamentally wrong. And it turned out to be fundamentally wrong because we didn't really have any data to back it up. People liked the theory because it felt comfortable and it was consistent and it was a fine old theory. But actually, there wasn't much to back it up. So in the end, it was quite easy to knock it over and replace it with this thing we call the Big Bang. And the Big Bang, though, is based on a huge amount of evidence. You know, the galaxies are moving away from us. We do see the radiation. We see young galaxies a long way away. Because we're seeing them so far away, we're seeing them at the birth of the universe when we had lots of young galaxies. The amount of hydrogen and helium in the universe is exactly what you would expect if there was a Big Bang. So there's a huge amount of evidence that backs up the Big Bang theory. Now, the Big Bang theory is not complete, and it's got gaps, and you know maybe the age of the universe will turn out to be 12 billion years rather than 14 billion years, and there are maybe bigger worries than that. But I'd be shocked if the whole Big Bang theory was completely overturned. I can see some big changes. I mean, one of the big changes, big questions about the Big Bang is that people thought that the universe should be slowing down. Gravity should slow down this expansion and stop the galaxies from flying apart. But the latest measurements show that the universe is actually flying apart faster and faster. It's accelerating. That's a big mystery. Nobody understands it. It's a huge gap in the Big Bang. But when it gets fixed, I don't think it'll overturn the Big Bang theory. So that's sort of why I wrote the book. I kind of felt this is a story. There'll be tweaks and changes to it, but fundamentally, the Big Bang theory won't be proved wrong.
Okay.
I mean, there are people who don't believe in the Big Bang, and that's great because we shouldn't get complacent, and they'll pull holes and you know poke fun at the Big Bang, and that'll help people patch up some of its gaps. And there's a tiny chance it's completely wrong and the whole thing is fundamentally flawed. But I just think that's unlikely. Yeah, I mean, that's why you know people thought gravity would slow down the expansion, cause a contraction, a big crunch, and then another big bang, and so on. Now, that seems unlikely now because of this runaway universe effect. But even if it did go big crunch, big bang, big crunch, big bang, for me, that wouldn't overturn the Big Bang theory. It's, you know, because the Big Bang theory sort of says, well, what's happened over the last 14 billion years? And you know, if that sort of theory turns out to be true, it would fill in what happened before that. So it would be an addition to rather than an overturning of.
Sir? Please go ahead.
You said that it was possible by studying the relative motions of the planet to estimate when the Big Bang occurred. Is it at all possible, or do you think it might be possible to decide where it occurred?
Yeah, I've glossed over a lot of things and simplified things, and I should say, I know there are lots of philosophers of science here, and if there are astronomers who want to chip in with additions to sort of my answers, please do. But in terms of this question, the simplification I've made is I've suggested that the galaxies are flying through space. Like you throw a stone, the stone goes through the air. If we all wanted to move apart, we could get up, move to the edge of the room, we would all be moving through space, okay? But that's not what's happening. What's happening on a cosmic scale is that space itself is expanding. So the analogy in this room would be, if this room doubled in size, space would expand. So in that case, instead of being 10 meters away, if the room doubled in size, you'd be 20 meters away. Instead of people on the front row being 3 meters away, they'd be 6 meters away. But from your point of view, you would see the gentleman next to you move from 1 meter away to 2 meters away. You would see me move from 10 meters away to 20 meters away. So from your point of view, you would also think that you were at the center of the universe. So wherever you are in the universe, it looks like you're at the center, but there isn't really a center. The data I've shown you so far, you know, the galaxies in that direction are heading that way, the galaxies in that direction are heading that way, it looks like we're at the center of the universe. But in fact, everybody gets that impression. And the Doppler shift, for example, that I explained, the fact that the light waves stretch, is actually due to the fact that space itself is stretching. So as the light travels towards us, it gets stretched, and that's why the galaxies look redder than you'd expect them to.
So this gentleman, and then up front row, and then down here, please. And then, sir, so in the third row, please.
You said earlier in your lecture that the theory of Big Bang has more or less discarded the idea of the primeval atom. Now, can you say what that idea is or was, and with what has it been replaced?
All right. So I think. So Lemaître's primeval atom idea was you literally just compact all the matter into some object to some finite size. And I don't know how big his object would have been, or I'm not very clear on that. The modern idea is that you actually run the clock all the way back so that all the matter we see today in the known universe goes back to singularity, ideally. Now, the problem is that the physics we have today can't cope with that. Of the densities of matter and what happens at a singularity, the laws of physics break down. So that's another gap in the Big Bang. We don't understand how it's going to end because we don't understand this runaway universe. We don't really know what happened at the instant of creation because the densities involved there are beyond the physics we have. And so people do research into things like string theory in the hope that string theory might throw light on that kind of physics. It might show us the sort of mechanism that happened at the Big Bang itself. But the idea now is not to go back to a finite object, but to go back to an infinitely small object.
Front row.
Hi, I really enjoyed your presentation, but I'm surprised that you're so confident in the theory of the Big Bang, especially because in physics, there's hardly any theories that have survived more than a few hundred years, largely intact. And I don't know if you're familiar with the work of Thomas Kuhn, who would argue that there's always changes in scientific paradigms and new methodologies are coming up that will displace the old paradigm. So what do you have to say about that?
I think I just think we all accept that atoms exist. You know, we just know that sodium is an atom. And we know how many electrons it's got. We know it's got a nucleus. And it's a theory with so much overwhelming evidence that we kind of call it a fact, because you know you disagree.
Have you ever seen
an atom? No. I'm quite willing for people to go out and prove that atoms don't exist. That's fine. I'm quite willing for people to say, well, actually, what's going on inside the nucleus is not quite what you think is going on inside the nucleus. And I'm quite willing for people to talk about the slight energy levels are slightly different from what we might think they are. But as a broad concept, for me, the atom isn't going to go away. Similarly, in answer to sort of the gentleman's first question, the broad idea of the Big Bang, for me, isn't going to go away. It might do, and it's wonderful that people continue to batter at it and attack it. You know, things like continental drift. I kind of just think continental drift is a real thing. I don't think that's going to go away. The mechanisms, you know, whether it's a conveyor belt and the inner mantle or the, you know, the inner core, you know, people may argue about mechanisms that drive continental drift or the rates at which it happens and what happens in a subduction zone. But basically that idea, to me, isn't going to go away. And that's kind of how I feel about the Big Bang. Maybe the Big Bang isn't on the same level as an atom or continental drift, but it's certainly not on a par with, I don't know, some, you know, string theory, for example, which is clearly highly speculative, or even some of the sort of more mainstream elements of quantum physics, which is still open for debate. But I'd be really interested if there are other people here who want to chip in on that.
Well, we'll come back to you, sir, but let's go through, if we may. So, first of all, towards the back, at the back here, on the ground floor, the stores, and then to the fourth row on my left, the gentleman in the white shirt.
What effect did the discovery that the universe was accelerating have on the estimate of the age of the universe?
I'm not sure, to be honest. The age of the universe, it partly depends on trying to think now. I mean, when I was a student 10, 15 years ago, the variation in age was between 10 and 20 billion years. It was a huge discrepancy. And over the last 5 or 6 years, that number's really been nailed down very heavily, partly by studying things like the microwave background radiation, partly by more accurate distance measurements of objects, partly by assessing their speeds more accurately and bringing into account this acceleration issue. And now the number is 13.7 billion years, which seems to suggest an accuracy in the date of the universe to about 1%. So I suspect, I'm just trying to think whether it's increased it or decreased it. Must have increased it. Fine, yeah. That seems to make sense. All I know is that the final number now is 13.7, which seems to accommodate things like our estimates of the oldest known galaxies and the oldest known objects in the universe all seem consistent with this number of 13.7. To be honest, I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
Okay, thank you, sir.
Hello. In the same way that you... It would be very, very difficult to explain what sight is to a blind man. Do you not think that all these theories, it's almost impossible for humans to sort of figure out what the universe is about because we can think in three dimensions, but the universe is probably in four, five, six, seven dimensions and therefore an impossibility to explain?
I gave a talk, one of the things called a Café Scientifique, where Café Scientifique in Brighton it was, and in that format, you only speak for about 15 minutes, and the bulk of the session is handed over to the audience to ask questions. And so there were two or three of us, the three of us there. One of them was Andrew Liddle, who's a cosmologist at Sussex. And somebody asked him a question about the shape of the universe. And he said, you know, people expect him to be able to imagine the shape of the universe. Because he's a cosmologist and he deals with it every day and he talks about it every day. And he said, essentially, he can't. He's a physicist and he understands the equations and he applies the equations. I'm going to say leap of faith, but that's not quite fair. It's the logic at the end of the day that drives him to his conclusions. And I think using logic, he's a mathematical, logical, scientific logic, we can begin to grapple with things which are incredibly abstract, especially if we then make predictions which we can test again, which are not abstract. So string theory, which is 26 dimensions and so on, it's hard to imagine, it's hard to deal with those kind of things in our head, even general relativity. But if our theory is correct, with general relativity, for example, we can spot an anomaly in the orbit of, say, Mercury, and we can measure that anomaly, which is not beyond our imagination, our scope. So we can always sort of seem to be able to bring it back down to Earth with things that our imagination can grapple with.
Thank you. You, sir, in the second row, and then at the back.
over there in the white shirt.
I very much enjoyed your experiment with the gherkin.
Thank you.
And I was wondering, what colour is given off when you electrocute a Teletubby?
I've no idea. It's interesting. I mean, I'm not encouraging people to try this, but I really am not encouraging people to try. But I've not tried it with anything else. It works well with gherkins because it's pickled in brine. The geometry of the object means that you draw about 10 amps, so you're not going to blow any fuses. But yeah. No, it's not being heated. If it was heating, it would go through being red hot and white hot and so on. But I think what happens is that there is some heating, and the heating dries away the moisture. Where there isn't any water, you get sparks occurring. When you get that sudden injection of high voltage, that seems to be what causes the excitation of the sodium atoms. And you get some sparks, you get some probably bits of salt being thrown out. You see steam coming off it rather than smoke. And that's the sort of thing that's going on. It actually dates back to, I first heard about this on Johnny Carson, the American chat show host who passed away last year, I think. And I didn't realize that Johnny Carson was fascinated by science. He had Carl Sagan on his show about a dozen times. He was an active member of the Skeptic Society. And he would have lots of scientists on and do scientific demos like this. I was completely unaware of it.
Sorry, is your comment about gherkins, sir? No, we'll come back to you in a minute. Sorry, in the white shirt.
Hi there. If I get it right, in the Big Bang, there's the beginning of time and space, and then there's the expansion of space, and I take it an extending duration of time or something. I don't get it. Can you throw any light on that, please?
Jeremy, somebody asked me this the other day, and I didn't know the answer, and I still don't. I didn't find out the answer.
Sorry, is the question what should one say about the idea that time begins?
I think the question is that time and we clearly have an expansion in space. Is there an expansion in the time dimension as well?
Yes. Well, I would say there isn't. But the real puzzle is not so much should we think of time as expanding or not, because I think it's quite natural to think that time is not expanding, but that what should we say to it? Feel more comfortable about the idea that time had a beginning. And that's a long struggle. In fact, as many people here know, and as Simon knows full well, no doubt it's in the book, these struggles really began in the mid-19th century with Riemann's generalized ideas of geometry, which was making geometry less readily visualized, partly because it was in higher dimensions than three. So I sympathize with anxiety about how could time possibly begin, or how could space and time begin a certain 13.7 billion years ago. But I think, as Simon was saying, after some months or years of inundating your mind with these ideas, you come to understand it, but you don't come to visualize it.
And I think, the question, what came before the Big Bang, which is kind of the biggest gap in the entire theory, it seems impossible. You know, how would we ever begin to address that question? Is it a question with any meaning? If time's created in the Big Bang, then you can't ask what came before the Big Bang. An analogy that I find kind of useful is, what's north of London? Well, Birmingham's north of London. What's north of Birmingham? Oslo. What's north of Oslo? The North Pole. What's north of the North Pole? We can't ask that question because northness itself is created at the North Pole. So it seems like a question that you can't really address. But for example, one possibility is that there was a universe before our universe, and that universe might have given birth to our universe and created time in our universe. And our universe, in due course, may spawn other universes. So you have a whole family tree of universes, each one being slightly different to its parent. And I think it was Auguste Comte, the French philosopher said, you know, there are some things in that we'll never, ever know. And number one on his list of things that we'll ever know, I think it was about the 1830s, he said number one on our list of things we'll never, ever know is what the stars are made of. So that's beyond human, you know, beyond human knowledge. And yet within 10 years of his death, we knew exactly what the stars are made of. So what seems impossible now, how would we ever prove that there was a universe before our universe? Well, in 10 years' time, maybe somebody will come up with a test. You know, you have to have that test, as we were talking about experiments and proving theories. So maybe somebody one day will address that question of what came before the Big Bang.
Sorry, can I just ask also just on that question, what does it mean for space to extend as well? What does it mean for space? Because surely you extend in space and other things.
Well, I mean, one of the things that people, I've sort of glossed over a lot of things. If everything was expanding, if the whole of space was expanding, then we would be expanding as well. And how would you know that other things were expanding? Because our measuring sticks and everything would be expanding with it. The expansion only occurs in the huge empty voids. In this room, on this Earth, in our solar system, in our galaxy, the density of matter means that the expansion doesn't occur. But once you go in between the galaxies, where there's nothing to counteract it or nothing to compensate for it, that's where the expansion really occurs. So literally the physical distance between our galaxy and the neighboring galaxy is getting bigger and bigger, except our neighboring galaxies are being pulled towards us by gravity. So you need to go a little way away to get rid of local effects. But once you go far enough away, there's a genuine, consistent expansion.
Okay, we have a good queue. The gentleman at the back, and then lady, third row, and then gentleman at the back here.
Hi, I'd like you to address two issues. Firstly, you said the universe was expanding. But, okay, let's take an analogy of a balloon in this room as the universe expanding. It can only expand into the confines of the walls of this room. Similarly, what does the universe expand into? Because space is in universe. Space is a part of the universe, so it can't be expanding into space.
Yeah, no, that's actually the question that Andrew Little started about imagining higher dimensions and so on. It could be that the universe is infinite and is just everything, and if it's infinite and you double it in size, it's still infinite. The other thing is it could be embedded in something, but whatever we're embedded in, we'll never be able to have access to it because this is our universe. By definition, it's sort of all we can ever have a hold on. So if it is in a higher dimension, we're going to be stuck in this one, unable to really maybe work out what that is. How many questions do we have left?
Well, we have time for 5 to 10 minutes more.
Okay.
But you can call the whole time.
I'm sorry.
You may have a question.
I mean, I know we had two or three people queued up. If we could go through those two or three, that'd be great.
Right. Good. So,
I imagine you must get this asked all the time. If you had to debate about the existence of God, which way would you go?
Oh God, I did a book tour of the States, and that sort of question came up a lot. It's interesting. People, I mean, for example, it seems there's a bigger battle about evolution. You know, people say, no, the science can't explain evolution, and they don't. People seem less worried about cosmology and God. Possibly because the Big Bang seems like Genesis, and the Pope, I think Pope Pius XII, endorsed the Big Bang, saying, look, this is a scientific vindication of Genesis. And Lemaître replied by saying to the Pope, look, just stay out of this, because you're just embarrassing us, because the other guys, the eternal universe people, say, look, the Pope said that the sun goes around the earth. And they were wrong about that. So if the Pope endorses the Big Bang Theory, that proves that the Big Bang Theory is wrong as well. And Lemaître was also saying, you know, you're using science to back up the Bible now. What happens if science comes up with something that contradicts the Bible? You can't pick and choose. So what Lemaître was saying is that the two are very separate. You know, use science to explore the material world, use religion to explore the spiritual world, and there doesn't need to be a conflict. And so similarly, I think, you know, I think there are cosmologists and scientists who believe in God, and there are those who don't. And I just don't think that...
Huh?
How many gods? We could plot a graph of number of gods versus theories you prefer. So.
Thank you. So, sir, back.
In one of your slides, you suggested that the speed of galaxies is, I mean, the speed by which they are moving is proportionate to the distance between two galaxies. So is there a distance that implies the galaxies to be moving at speed of light? And would that give an outer limit to the size of the universe?
I think there is a problem that there are galaxies. One thing is it if you've got two galaxies on the far reaches of the universe, the speed between them will be faster than the speed of light. But what the speed limit is really about is the communication of information. You can't communicate information between those two galaxies. But the problem is that those galaxies are both quite similar in their distribution of matter and so on. So one of the puzzles is how come those two galaxies, right on the opposite edges of the universe, are so similar to, or those two regions of the universe are so similar to each other, when they've never ever had the time to communicate between each other. And so one of the ideas that's emerged is something called inflation. And what inflation says is that at the very, very early times of the universe, soon after creation, there would have been a super expansion. And the universe would have doubled in size and doubled and doubled and doubled, think about 100 times in something like a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second. Now what that means is that early on in the universe you could have had bits of the universe that were very, very close together, and so that's why they're very similar. And because of this super runaway expansion, they'd have moved apart dramatically. And so today they're a long way apart, but they're still very similar because originally they seem close together. Is that more or less correct? Is that a semi-respectable? Okay.
So, thank you, Simon. One last question from the black T-shirt.
What I've tried to do in the book is to focus on the Big Bang theory up to about 1970, 1980, because I think once we get to about 1980, or even 1990, I suppose, really, that's when we get the final concrete bits of evidence, where the final few big, major, embarrassing gaps of the Big Bang get filled in. And what I've not done in the book, I have a short epilogue at the end, which points to questions about inflation, the runaway expansion of the universe, and so on. So those are areas which I'm much less clear about. But there are many great books that look at those unknown questions in modern cosmology. And those are interesting areas. But what I've tried to do is to stop at the point where we've kind of got a complete picture of what we do know. And I've highlighted the gaps of what we don't know, but I haven't really looked into them in great detail.
Hi. I hear you used to be a particle physicist, and you gave up particle physics for writing books, which is great because that gave us all your great books. But that also meant science had to sacrifice particle physicists.
Oh, it didn't lose much. Really,
I'd like to hear your comment on the importance of popularizing science, making it available to society, and also how do you think scientists are doing this job, because after all they're funded by society, and do you think we are doing a proper job in making science available to the public?
I think if scientists can communicate, then they should. You know, but there's no reason why scientists should be able to. Scientists are scientists because they're good at doing science. But if somebody enjoys it and they have a talent for it, then they should be encouraged to do it. I think sometimes there's a certain resentments amongst scientific communities when somebody gets plucked out to become a representative and a spokesman in a certain area. And I think that's a shame, because those figures can encourage more people into that field and excite a new generation of scientists. But the real people who excite the next generation of scientists are clearly teachers. When I was growing up, it was the teachers that got me excited about science. And the problem nowadays, I think, is that if you're good at science, and if you're good at communicating, and if you can inspire and engage people, then there are companies that will offer you huge salaries to go and work for them. So people get tempted out of teaching. And if you have fewer people teaching, then you get fewer people studying science, fewer people doing degrees in science, fewer people becoming teachers, fewer people studying science. those people become even more precious. So they get lured away even more. And at the moment, we seem to be in a sort of downward spiral. And I'm just not convinced that the government's taking it seriously. In America, it's a big problem. But in America, you can bring in people from India and South Korea to fill in that gap and to build, you know, the Googles and so on of the future. But in this country, it just strikes me that in 15, 20 years' time, we're going to have a real deficit of innovators and entrepreneurs and engineers, as well as having a society that's, you know, more likely to believe in crystal healing and Reiki than it is going to believe in MMR and sort of real medicine that works.
Okay. Well, I'm afraid, ladies and gentlemen, we've brought to a close, not least because there is a chance as you leave to meet Simon for a minute and also to buy a book at a wonderful discounted price. Signed copies, but they're on the right in that direction. But before we break up, I would like to say that, you know, despite those rather trenchant words, that's a sad ending. It's been a joy, Simon, to hear you, not least because, speaking of the, you know, virtues of pedagogy, the fact is that we're all going to manage much better with the younger generation when we go home tonight, on account of having, on the one hand, Teletubbies, and on the other hand, for the older types, Led Zeppelin. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.